Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of UAP Studies. We're joined again by Michael Glosson, which is joining us from the States. I forgot, Michael, what state are you in right now?
I'm in Charleston, South Carolina.
South Carolina.
Sweaty armpit of America right now.
I bet it's pretty hot right now, eh?
Yeah. I think they actually gave us a warning just to not go outside at all today. So I canceled all my plans for the rest of the day.
That's a pretty serious warning when they say just stay indoors, right? You know it's freaking hot.
Yeah. Stay indoors and check on your neighbors was the two things. So I'm not checking on my neighbors because they're all like 23 years old.
They're all jerks. I'm not checking up on them. They're all jerks. This is part two, guys. We wanted to have Michael back on because the first conversation we had was pretty mind-blowing. Did you have any slides or anything today, Mike, that you need to share?
No visuals.
I can give you access. No visuals. We're good.
No visuals.
But the subject of philosophy, especially when it comes down to ufology, is very important. At some point in our past, philosophy and science parted. They were once one and the same, but it did part, and it becomes almost like dogmatic approach now to science that you can't think any differently than what the facts are, which I think is we're missing some stuff, right?
Sure. Yeah, that's sort of the history of all disciplines. Philosophy sometimes is called the person who helps you give birth.
The doula or whatever.
The doula discipline.
Midwife or whatever, something.
Right? Yeah, midwife discipline. So we sort of give birth to all these other disciplines, and before they're ready, they were always philosophy. You know, politics used to just be philosophy. Science used to be called natural philosophy. But at some point, you get a list of like standard questions and standard methods that you use, and it kind of goes off on its own, becomes its own discipline. But then, of course, like you're saying, there's that danger that you're going to become a sort of dogma. You're going to become a like set in stone, and you're going to have boundaries outside of which you can't think. And that's what philosophy is here to always do, is to help you think outside of those boundaries that you've set for yourself.
Right. And knowing, I think, you know, when Aristotle, Plato, Socrates, I mean, when they sort of really started emphasizing, like, you know, what is thought? Like, did you think this through? Why do we do this? Right. Like, just the questioning. That's a beautiful aspect of learning that you know nothing, which is the first step, I think, in learning anything, is to understand that as much as I think that I know now at 42, I just understand, like, it's weird. It's like a reverse effect. You think you know everything when you're young, and then by the time you're older, you realize how little you know and how much time you've wasted not knowing the things that you should have been knowing.
Yeah.
It's so weird, but it's like a psychological effect of life. And I think the longer we live as a species, because we didn't have time to think that far back in the past when we lived at 22, 24 years old, sure, and then died of gangrene or some sort of weird infection.
You had to spend your whole life working, you know.
And just surviving. You didn't have time to think, what am I? What are these things? Right. Like, I think that came along with civilization. We started questioning things. We had more leisure time because other things were provided for us. We didn't have to worry about that. And it's interesting because we started reflecting on ourselves, our nature, and just fighting against our own species to make them realize something that should be evident. Right. And I think as a philosopher, for you, it must be maddening when you just, like, especially now on YouTube and Twitter and ufology in question, too, is that everybody's opinionated. Everybody thinks, no, this guy is valid. This guy is not valid. Like, they're so certain of themselves. Well, I'm not certain of anything. I'm just like, I have to observe it. Right.
Yeah, it's sort of maddening, but in one way, it's encouraging because people are thinking, right? People are finding their own positions on things. And so as a teacher, I taught at universities for over a decade. And one of the more frustrating things is when people come into your classes and they don't seem to have any view at all, or at least they don't feel any confidence in expressing what they think. That's more disheartening than a person who has a view and sticks to it, because you can maybe wiggle them out of their dogmatism or their sense of security. So in one sense, it's encouraging, but in another sense, it's discouraging, because as a philosopher, maybe the thing that I sort of distinguishes us the most is that we have this love for not knowing, this love for that experience of going like, oh my God, that's a complicated question. I have no idea what to think of that. For most people, that's deeply uncomfortable. And for me, it's like the equivalent of a roller coaster or something. It's thrilling to wade into a topic that's interesting and about which I just can't figure out what to think.
Yeah, and it forces us to think differently than we'd like to go. Because the thing is, with this subject, especially if we're dealing, let's say, with non-entities, non-human entities, the question of philosophy needs to come back. Philosophy needs to be implied here big time, because it's not just the science of it, but the implications of it all. The technology leaking into society, society's use of this alien technology, eventually understanding what aliens are and non-entities are. And like, there's major implications to our civilization. And even like, I think back, because, you know, you study this stuff, but everybody that said, you're not a big fan of Ayn Rand. I am. I like some of her philosophy, not all of it, but some aspect of it I like. But you mentioned something that was quite interesting, that you prefer people to come into your class with a foundation or a base already on an opinion rather than somebody who has none. Why is it dangerous not to have an opinion and just to be neutral on anything?
Well, I think that it's sort of our natural inclination is to gravitate towards some idea that we can use and like get through the world with. So when a person feels reluctant to, I don't know, lean in any direction at all, or sort of identify any direction as the one that kind of appeals to them the most, it kind of signals to me that they've been taught against their own natural nature to not commit intellectually to something. And so they just sort of sit back and observe a lot, which can be good. But I think there's something sort of unnatural about people who are like, I just don't even know what to think. I don't think about that. That tells me that they've been kind of traumatized out of it or discouraged from doing their own thinking. And that's kind of just our natural state, is to think and wonder and lean in one direction or another.
Yeah. And also socially, people teach us what's appropriate, what's not. Like when people used to bring up UFOs, even 10 years ago, people's natural reaction was to laugh it off and to dismiss it. And that's not, you know, it's not the case today, but that there was a shift there. Right. There was a shift in mentality or approach to saying, OK, maybe it's OK for you to talk about it now. But that did a lot of damage, you know, not addressing something. It's like saying, hey, leaves are green and everybody argues with you. So stating facts. And I always think about that, like, what are the implications of mankind? Just for those, like you mentioned, that don't think or don't have a foundation, like this will rock their world because they've never contemplated anything outside the limited space they allow for themselves. What do you think that does to the individual? And in the second part of that question, what do you think that would do as a civilization? Like, what do you think the implications of that are?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the first thing to roll back just a little bit on is, you mentioned that when we initially started talking about UFOs in like the late 40s or early 50s or whatever, people kind of laughed at it. But what I think they laughed at was not at the phenomena that we use the term for, because those seem to have been around for a very, very long time. Like all of human history, we've got some analogs to, you know, things flying around in the sky. If you go to pretty much any time or place in human history and ask people, like, do you know anything about like little people who fly around and shiny objects? Everybody's like, oh yeah, we hear about those, but only crazy people believe in them or whatever. But so it's not that they're laughing at. It's when we gave it a name and sort of conceptualized it, that we could also start like putting it into Hollywood movies and making tabloid headlines about it. That's when it became a subject about which we could laugh. It was that framing that somehow American early sci-fi era America put around this phenomenon that made it laughable. But I think that the bigger question you asked was, what does it do to people when you introduce this like completely framework shattering idea into their world? And honestly, I don't know, because if you look back historically, there have been large periods, just in American, North American history, there have been long periods where people tended to think that there were like other life forms in the world. I mean, look at the Mormon movement of the 19th century. I mean, the second Mormon prophet was saying that there were people who like lived on the sun, and lots of people believed that, and it didn't seem to like change very much. Like maybe they thought about it and thought it was really cool or whatever. But even prior to that, there are like long periods where European tracts were being printed about people who lived on the moon and how you could see the canals and things up there. And it didn't seem to do a whole lot, but I think maybe what would change people's perception of their own reality is the idea that there's some interchange, that there's some other intelligence that's here and interacting with us in some way. And that might might shatter things a lot for them, especially if it gets framed as something that you need to be afraid of. Like you and I have talked privately a lot about the abduction phenomenon. And if that becomes like the primary framework around which we start talking about UAP or whatever's behind UAP, and I'm not even convinced that it's extraterrestrial. I'm kind of agnostic on that question. But if that becomes the chief framework and people start thinking about the possibilities of abduction, then it might, yeah, it might trigger a lot of fear. But if we start talking about the possibilities of technological advancements or healing diseases or whatever sorts of things we might be able to get out of technology, and again, I'm have a little bit of skepticism about whether we even could take technology from another world and easily transfer it into any application here. Maybe we could, but I think there's some reasons to think maybe we can't very easily. But if we could, then that framework leads us down a different emotional reactionary path. And so I think it's kind of an open question. We're at a crossroads right now in this conversation. How is it going to get framed? And that's going to determine to a large part how people respond to it emotionally.
Yeah, and this, like, the further we go into the rabbit hole that is UFO and alien abduction and cattle mutilation and all that, the more questions pop up. And for me, the more philosophical questions pop up as well. Like, oh man, like, what are the implications of that? And we were talking just the other night, you and I, just about, like, you know, Congress coming out and like hearing about this. And there's also a dark side to ufology, which people don't tend to cover
No
much, but
question. Yep.
yeah, the dark side of it, of, you know, not only the illegal things that were done, the crimes that were committed to keep this a secret, but also the cases that seem like people were killed by non-human entities. And that's a scary bit. That's a part that we, you know, I know with Stephen Greer, he's very much on that, like, no, they're friendly, we're the ones who are hostile, but I'm not wholly convinced. I think there's, and we were mentioning this too about the black and white, like it's either this or that. What about the gray zone? There's got to be a gray zone, right? They're called grays after all, aren't they? So there's got to be a gray zone.
That's a convenient analogy.
Yes,
Yeah. No,
exactly.
I think that there's an argument to be made that we should just do away with any hope that if we encounter a completely non-human intelligence, that they're going to be totally benign, right? And for the same exact reasons that encountering any other species, you can't say, well, bears are totally benign or jellyfish are totally benign. I mean, jellyfish don't even have minds, right? So they can't even properly be benign or angry, but it would be silly to say they're totally benign. Because any non-human intelligence or species is going to have aims of its own that aren't constructed purely with regard to our well-being. And to say that something is totally benign is just to say that all of its aims really take us into an account and do so in a way that's for our benefit. And it just cannot be that, like, if we encounter some completely non-human intelligence that is already going to have constructed all of its aims and projects and intentions and biological needs and things in order to accommodate our well-being. That just seems
Yeah.
too good to be true. So the best we can hope is that they would be nice and would try to take our well-being into account, but there's no telling how they might calculate things. I mean, if they have needs of their own and they're going to have to at some point ask questions about whether they should sacrifice our well-being for their own. And we know how those kind of thoughts go with our own species. So it's probably going to be the same with theirs.
Yeah, and I often think that ego at some point must exist in their society. Like, I don't think you can progress technologically and to survive. Like, you need defense mechanisms and weapons to be able to do so. So a part of protecting of self and self-interest is going to be part of these species. I mean, if they're here operating, it's for self-interest. It's not, like you said, for the benefit of us surviving. It's there's a purpose they're here. The scary bit is that it is a multitude of different things. So it's not, and we, I think we addressed this last time. I think that I would fare better and society would fare better if, you know, it comes out like, look, we made contact with an alien species, a alien species. They seem to be friendly. We're communicating right now. See if we can meet. The public, I think, would be able to react to that better because you're only dealing with one fact, right? One entity. We can handle that. But this subject might be really deep in the sense of, like, we, it might be extraterrestrial, ultra-dimensional, interdimensional, you know, something that's already been here, something that's from the future. Like, there's a multitude of possibilities, and it could all exist in the same realm as well. We don't know. That's a scary bit. because there's some I'm sure are friendly and don't mean us any harm, but the others, even we're talking about the cattle mutilations that humans are found in the same way as these cattle. And I was thinking about this after a conversation on Friday. And if we were to send a drone out to another planet to dissect an animal that's there, do you think we would care if the droid did it with finesse or kindness?
Of course not. No. I mean, look, we have the answer to that question, right? We do this sort of stuff all the time. We kill tons of animals in sort of brutal, cruel ways. I mean, just to test things like our shampoo, we're rubbing it in the eyes of, you know, rabbits and things like that. So yeah, our own concern for our and our fellow, you know, evolutionary siblings' well-being is pretty abysmal. So it might be the case that, you know, if some other intelligence comes here and they try to figure out, well, how should we treat these things, that they would just look at how we treat one another and say, oh, well, that's the norm, let's just follow that. And that would be really bad for us if they did that.
Yeah. I understand our human nature won't apply to their nature. It'll be quite different. In the Bible, God says my ways are different than your ways, as like the heaven is from earth or earth is from heaven. Meaning it's just such a different way of thinking that you're not going to get there. And I think this is the issue that bugs me the most, because we're going to throw all our scientists and everything that we can at this, and philosophy and people of different fields of study need to investigate this and try to put this as a collective, because it bleeds into every aspect of our lives, like every aspect, even to the core of consciousness. We're talking a bit about consciousness and, you know, what does that mean as the individual? Like when your rights, it's not really a right. It's, you know, amongst ourselves, it's a right, human rights, but for them, they could come and go and just do what they want to you at any point in time. And there's
you
nothing.
You mean our right to, like, you're talking about our right to, like, not have our own free will impinged upon, like in abduction cases where a person says that, oh, I was just completely paralyzed, or my memory was completely wiped or something.
Yeah.
You're talking about that being sort of like a violation on us, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you hear that a lot in the abduction cases, that it's a violation of your body because you can't control it, violation of your consciousness because you do whatever they tell you to do. They tell you to forget about it, you forget about it. Like, that superiority, I think, is the hardest part for these abductees, is to explain how superior these things are to us. And it seems like they have every right. You know, people say, you don't have a right to do this. And they say, no, we have every right. Or you signed up for it. Like, there's a weird thing that's going on there. But I think that maybe that's the part for these abductees, Mike, that is the hardest part to cope with, is a complete lack of any control over it.
Yeah, that sense of violation. I mean, so this is something where my philosopher hat on, I can actually contribute something straight from my discipline.
Please, yeah.
Rights are something that, just the whole concept, did not emerge until way late in human history. I mean, we're like talking about like sort of John Locke's era in England, right, with, you know, John Donne and other people were.
So it's fairly recent. Yeah,
we didn't really have that concept guiding our ethics for a long time. And it sort of fell out of legal theory. Like, what gives you the right to something? It started with questions like, what gives you the right to a piece of land? And the idea, well, at least Locke's idea, that America's legal philosophy is founded on, is like, oh, you work a piece of land with your bare hands, and that's what gives you the right to sort of ownership or something. So that whole concept fell out of these sorts of discussions. It's not something that we automatically bring into the world. And so it would be kind of strange to think that when you talk to an alien race or an extra off-world race, that they would have developed that same concept along the same lines, especially if their biology or psychology are completely different. But what more deeply, what people seem to be objecting to in these abduction cases that you mentioned is what we call in philosophy bodily autonomy. The right or the ownership over your own body, and to direct your own body's experience, and to be the one who controls what you go through and what you experience and how you experience it, right? So a lot of times in moral philosophy, we talk about, like, rape, for instance. The wrongness of rape is construed in terms of violating a person's bodily autonomy, what position their body is in and what they feel and things like that, that should be yours. So it seems like that's kind of the ground upon which a lot of people are not complaining, because that makes it sound petty, but the way that they feel traumatized by the experience of abduction is that their autonomy of their own body has been violated, sort of in like a rapey way, which I can understand and hear. But if the if whoever's doing the violating doesn't have a similar relationship to their own body and their own consciousness, then we might not expect them to understand what it's like to go through that.
Yeah, good point. Because if that's something that they're used to or something that they do themselves, like, they wouldn't see from our point of view that, and there's no, you know, for the people that do come back relatively unharmed. I mean, there's some issues there, but it's interesting. It's interesting that they could do that to you, but yet, you know, we often joke like they don't throw you out the airlock when they're done. At least they return you to the right place where they took you from. Most of the time, we don't know. Maybe there's some.
What's his name? Is that his name? Tim Scott, the guy who was abducted and then dropped off like several miles away from where he was a few days later. I can't remember. Randy Scott.
Are you thinking about like the Fire in the Sky incident, or
That guy?
You got Tim in my head. It's not Tim. The audience is going to kill us right now. They're probably shouting it out right now.
Just look into the comments and they'll tell you. Right.
Yeah.
Blowing around our heads.
You
now.
Said Tim, and now my head is stuck on that. Fire in the Sky was Tim Walton's. But that's crazy, you know. But the thing is, that was a rescue mission because they took him in the middle of the woods. They had no place to put him back. We're not going to put him back there. Right?
That's a good point. Yeah.
So they're like, the nearest town, near a phone booth. Like, they did him a service for sure. And you hear stuff like that, you're like, man, that shows kindness. Like when he mentioned Travis Walton, not Tim Walton, Travis Walton. Mm. Thank you.
But, sorry, I've got you murdered in the comments. But
yeah. Fair enough. It's early. But it's crazy because he thinks that it was a rescue mission after a while because his friends left him. He was in really bad shape. And when he woke up, they were working on the painting behind me is from his point of view when he woke up and he could see three entities above us. Yeah, that's his hand up there or whatever. I mean, that's not legit what happened, but a rendition of it. And it's scary because you realize that there's no ill intent there. You know, they did him a service. They brought him back. They kept him alive. It was a weird experience for sure. Like, I think and that's the thing. It's an alien experience. Like, how do you describe it? And they always say, oh, it was like this, but not really. Like, and I could totally understand. We don't have the lexicon for that yet. Right.
And that's really one of the things that when I started getting some level of interest in people's experiences with UAP and abductions and things, one of the things that was most compelling to me was reading testimonies where people would say that they didn't quite have the vocabulary to explain their experiences, right? Because people don't mistake some normal experience for something they don't have any vocabulary for,
right?
If you see something streak across the sky and it was actually a weather balloon or it was actually a meteor, you might mistake it for something else, but you don't mistake it in a way that says, oh, you know, it was just some color that I've never really seen before. I can't even talk about what the surface texture was like. It was sort of like aluminum, but it was also sort of like woody or transparent or whatever. Those sort of outside of your normal vocabulary experiences kind of convey a truthiness to me, a truth-like quality that I can't find in other places. You just don't find them in the realm of normal human experience. And that's kind of what started making me think, like, oh, these people experienced something. Well, I knew they experienced something, but it's not just a mundane experience that they mistook because it's outside of their normal vocabulary of experiential descriptors.
Yeah, I think maybe the closest thing to that is somebody has an acid trip and they go through and they see different things. They can't describe it. They've never had that happen before. There's no point of reference as a person going through these experiences. Like, there's nothing you could latch on that makes any sense. So, yeah, that's interesting. And when you hear the commonalities between these abductees and the things that they go through, like not only the emotions, but things that are said to them or messages that are left, like, it's very interesting. And on Friday, we were talking about the Zimbabwe case in 94. Yeah. And that's crazy because that little entity, when he turned around and addressed the kids, it was like some like 60 odd what kids, but each one from the little guys all the way to the older ones, each got a different message from that being at the same time. Like, how superior is that intellectually to us? Like, I've never been able, like, I could convey with my words things that will make sense to another Homo sapien, but to convey emotions and show them things about the future and stuff, like, to 60 individuals, like, that is scary. And that is not something that we can even fathom at this point.
Yeah, I only know the basic outlines of that case. Did the kids ever, like, convey what messages were given to them individually? Or was
some
it, like,
of them did. Yeah, so some of them did. So right after it happened, it got given to the Harvard professor, John Mack. Mm-hmm. And John Mack, of course, was fascinated with the abduction phenomenon. And he was a huge inspiration on me to start the podcast and begin with. But he flew down there and he started interviewing. And what they did is that they separated the little guys, like in kindergarten stuff, because they were freaked out. They didn't want to traumatize them. So they didn't interview them, but they interviewed the kids who were a little bit older. And one of the kids, you know, she was saying that she felt like it was saying, come with us, come with us. Like it really wanted to. Some of the ones were terrified. They were, you know, getting messages of end of times and just global warming. And each kid, I mean, I don't know what each kid received, but each one said that they could hear them or like understand their emotions and their mind. It's a really weird thing, telepathy, right? And that always fascinated me. And those kids still today, there's a documentary that came out not too long ago on this. It's called Aerial School. Mm-hmm. It's fascinating because he takes people that were there, kids that were there, back to that, and they legitimately have PTSD, like they have post-traumatic stress from this incident.
Sure, they did.
Yeah, like this one little girl, her parents were very fundamentally Christian. There's no way she could talk to them about this life-changing experience that she experienced. Even the teachers in school after a while told the kids not to talk about it because it was too much. But it's fascinating, and it's not the only time that these entities appear at schools. They do that often throughout the world.
There's an Australia case also, right?
Yes, England, Canada, a bunch of them, even playgrounds and stuff like that. Like, there's an actual interest in our kids, and not only that, but the development of our species. It's interesting, man. Like, this, it brings up so many questions, like, why, right?
Well, children are objectively better and more interesting than adults. So
hands down.
See why, yeah.
And great observers too, because they'll take everything in. I think as adults, we have blinders on. There's a lot of things we don't see because we're conditioned not to see it. And kids will report things that, you know, adults can't really say. And their experience is different. You know, when they're little, these entities are almost like friends, like children that they play with. When they're older, it becomes more traumatizing. But I think that's because you start realizing that it's not normal, or your brain is now conditioned to saying stating absolutes, which I still have a hard time with that, Mike. Stating absolute. Absolutely. Yeah. Especially in this field. And it's hard because you gotta pick a lane and drive in it. Right. And I say that to people, you gotta pick, like, your article that you had, you picked your niche. Philosophy, right? And I'm talking about for the people listening, the article in a debrief. What was the title?
I think that Micah, who's a much better editor and sort of person, I don't even know how to say it, pitcher than I am, gave it a title like, "It's time to rethink some of our basic assumptions about UFOs" or something like that.
Yeah, but it nailed it on the head because that's exactly what your article was about. And it brings about the question of getting philosophers. I got some that add me on LinkedIn, right? Mm-hmm. Which is great, but I'd like to see them more engaged like yourself to actually cover this subject, because it is a huge part of it that, you know, the questions, the why, the implications, even we talk about disclosure, mm-hmm. the implications of disclosure. And you brought up like multiple angles that I never even thought about. Like, one thing leads to another, right? Yeah. One problem leads to multiple other problems. And depending on which path we take, you had a chart, which was just like fascinating.
I'm going to put that up at some point in the next 2 weeks or so, and I'll let you link to it. But the idea was to show like how complex any particular disclosure scenario is and how many implications it has, and questions for policy and questions for international diplomacy and how to handle like homeland security and all these other things. Like every one of them is so deeply fraught and complex that there's a million ethical questions to to ask for how you'd handle it. And one of the disappointing things of thinking about this is that it makes me much more sympathetic to a point of view of maybe government insiders who are like, just hide everything. Just don't tell anybody anything because the risk is too high and the complexities are so unknown. I mean, governments especially don't like engaging with the unknown. It's just they can't control it, right? So I can really understand why there's hesitancy on the side of anybody who knows anything to tell people. And it also makes sense, like at a personal level. One thing I get a lot now are people emailing me asking, and I don't have children, but people asking me, how should I talk to my kids about this? I've gotten at least three different people email me with that specific question. I'm like,
good question, though. Great question.
Yeah. I mean, as a person who doesn't have kids, I'm like, just tell them everything. Just tell them whatever you think is true and tell them, here are the options that other people think. And we don't really know, but here's the evidence that we're considering and so forth. And I think they're afraid that'll overwhelm their kids. And maybe it will, but I was overwhelmed by everything as a kid. So I just kind of don't have the built-in sympathy for that experience because it's going to be fine. You know, nobody's going to like their head's not going to explode or whatever. But I'm probably not the person to ask, actually. So for those of you who are thinking about emailing me, asking me for parental advice, I'm just give them some LSD and let them.
Parenting time with Michael Lawson.
Yeah, right.
You got puppets and stuff. Yeah, that's pretty. Yeah. I don't know how I got into this. This is weird. Yeah.
But I do know.
Well, yeah. And, you know, the thing is, we were talking about the crimes that are also involved in this and the implications of once these crimes come out, people being mad and more distrust in their government because now they know their government went above and beyond what is morally right to keep this secret.
I think you were talking about cover-ups and the crimes of like military people being endangered or physically harmed by their encounters with these things, right? I mean, I know Gary Nolan is working on a lot of real cases right now with pilots, I think, who had UAP encounters and who suffered what can be characterized as brain damage from it. And of course, there are other lots of examples. I mean, you and I talked about the flap of Chupa cases in 1977 in Brazil and the burns that people received from that. And so that's just civilians, people who've been dispatched to specifically interact with these kinds of technologies or beings or whatever it is that they're encountering have certainly gotten physically damaged and psychologically damaged too.
Yeah. Well, even now in Peru, I think there's something going on too.
Tell me about this because I haven't followed this story and you have.
Well, my basic understanding is that it's a remote village, but these villagers have been attacked by some sort of predatory entity, has claws or something, but it's also camouflage. It's almost like, think Predator with Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Like literal Predator.
Predator. And they said that it slashed one of the girl's throats and they saved her, but it wasn't pretty. And that these villagers have been attacked almost nightly by these things. So they're pleading. And you got to think too, Michael, for some to be like, you know, I mentioned that before, but some to be remote to get attention from the U.S. government to go down or to get any government to go down and investigate it. They must have been going through this for quite some time and dangerous enough to send out people to go get help. Right. So I'm not sure. I'm following up on it every day, seeing if I can get any more news on this. Today we are August 13th. So when we're recording this, it's August 13th. Mm-hmm. So there might be news that comes out since this podcast is released. But that's my basic understanding right now. And it's not uncommon that attacks take place in the southern part of the hemisphere. Like, you know, you mentioned the 1977 case, like people seem to be hurt or found in really weird ways down there. I'm not sure if it happens in North America. If it does, it's very much diluted amongst our population and nobody talks about it. But down there, it's prevalent. Like, it seems like it's not good. They're being attacked or being zapped or major implications. Yeah. Like I said, it's a scary bit of ufology that we never talk about.
It might be there's like a selection problem, too, in that if we found people with slashed throats in America, we'd almost certainly attribute it to like one of the, I think there's like 1,000 serial killers loose at any point in North America.
Scary.
You would probably just attribute it to something like that. I mean, you're going to have to go through a lot of weird evidence before you knock all those things off the you know, your list of guesses and start saying, well, maybe this was some extraterrestrial or exotic thing. Whereas if it happens in a small village and you've got everybody kind of testifying, maybe it's harder to attribute it to something like a serial killer or whatever. But I don't know. That's a bizarre story. especially the degree to which it kind of mirrors a real fictional story that we have in like the Predator films or something. It makes me think of Jacques Vallée's control hypothesis, where the phenomena actually manifest according to like cultural icons and stories that we already have. Like,
right.
It's something that sort of feeds off and takes forms that are familiar to us or specifically for the purpose of being confusing or absurd. Most that's kind of the feeling it has a sort of sense of absurdity if like real predators are starting to like pop up into reality, which of course I have no idea what's going on down in Peru, but that's my initial thought.
Yeah, but I just think like that, how scary that would be if you're like, okay, once you admit that this is happening, then you're like, okay, this is happening, right? We need people now at this point, and trying to convince people that your life is threatened by something that doesn't seem to be human. But again, like, you hear stories like that all the time, Skinwalker Ranch, just things walking on hind legs that should not be, and just from fictional, you know, science fiction becomes science fact at some point. You know, somebody said that a while ago, and I love that because it's true. Like, whatever it is that we can dream up is probably somewhere out there in the universe, right?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, so that's the scary bit. But yeah, we were talking about the crimes and admittance, of course, of that, and the implications of not only the crimes that the government has committed. And I say government, it's not government, they're not aware, but these clandestine operations have done a lot of things. They're not so keen on killing people now because it's a lot more evident. People go missing and suddenly their TikToks and their podcasts are no longer coming out. There's going to be some problems. But in the past, they've ruined families, divorces, and just from fear that they've caused. And I always think about, you know, yes, a lot of these people are dead, but there's got to be some sort of accountability at some point. Right, because of this closure, and that's coming as well. What are your thoughts on what should be our approach when we start asking for questions on their behavior on this? Like, how would we go about that?
Yeah, one thing that occurs to me is that probably a lot of this like intimidation behavior, which no doubt exists in all sorts of forms, especially when it comes with the military, the sort of intimidation behavior of like, you'll hear people tell stories of I think this happened in one of the Pentagon Papers cases where it wasn't Bob Woodward, or it was some other informant dude said that a guy had told him to his face, like, you didn't see any of this. You don't know of this. If anything comes out, you know, you're dead, or something, just like some really shady, very like cliche threat. And what occurs to me in retrospect is that there are a lot of people in the military who have absolutely no authority to do anything to your family. They couldn't do it if they wanted to, but they can certainly say that and intimidate you. And then there's no possibility of accountability because they could deny that they ever said it. And then they can also say, well, I couldn't have even done such a thing, so why would I say it? Like, I imagine that a lot of these intimidation tactics are just, you know, they're just bluffs, right? If a person ever shows up at your door and says that they're, you know, they're going to burn your house down if you tell anybody about a UFO that you saw, my guess is that they're probably bluffing. But then we have to ask, what about the people who've really been harmed? And the ones that I know the most about are people who've been harmed through sort of psychological, I don't know, manipulation and constant harassment, like
gaslighting type thing.
Like Billie Holiday, you know, the FBI tried to get her to commit suicide by just like being mean to her and depriving her of her heroin and things like that.
You know, based on David Grush's allegations, they do that within the military. Like, they'll demote you and kill your entire career if you even approach the subject.
Sure, that is real. I mean, certainly they can do that.
Yeah.
So when you ask about accountability for that, probably you can't get accountability for ruining somebody's career within your own organization. I mean, there'd be some sort of civil rights lawsuit, probably, or employment rights lawsuit. But the government has already constructed, especially the military, has constructed its organizations in such a way to have all these levels of opaqueness that you can't see, that a court can't just dig into. So as sad as it is, there's probably not a lot of hope for accountability in the end for a lot of these individual cases. When you get to weird cases where people have actually died, been killed or something, which I don't know many of those cases, there's probably a higher hope because there's just no, at least as far as I know, there's no protocol for just summarily executing a person for doing something wrong on their job. But I don't know, are there specific cases that you're troubled most by?
Well, I was talking to a gentleman once, and he's a field investigator with MUFON and a past experiencer. And he was mentioning he was investigating the case, and he realized he's being tailed by, you know, government looking cars. And he says everything's fine. He hits the highway, and then all of a sudden he's 40 minutes away from where he was. Driving, I think, in the opposite direction, something like that. And it was caused by these people in the car, which, you know, you normally hear about missing time when, you know, you hear about alien abductions or some sort of encounter.
Oh, he's 40 minutes away from where he like skipped ahead 40
minutes. Exactly. He notices that he's being, and it was him and somebody else, I think, in this pickup truck. And you think, what? You know, that's pretty scary. Like, do they have a weapon? Do they have something? You know what I mean? Like, the accountability of what's being used on us based off of this technology. That, to me, is a crime against humanity. Using alien technology, that's treason to the human race, as far as I'm concerned. Hmm. You're using something from that's too powerful that can be created by humans against humans, right? Sure. And the mind control and stuff. We know the CIA has done a bunch of things on mind control and all that. But that involves bodies. It's never clean. It's never a clean job. It's not like they're going to hire people and, you know, scientists and stuff like that. Bob Lazar mentioned that, you know, scientists have been killed trying to reverse engineer. Russians have been captured. They were working at S4 and they had some sort of breakthrough. Within 24 hours, the four Russians had been kidnapped. And that's when they handed Bob Lazar a gun and said, you need to defend yourself. So shit's going down behind the scenes, like anything breakthrough and stuff like that. Like these clandestine operations, they're good at what they do. They'll bust in. They have SWAT teams. They'll, you know, they know what the hell they're doing at this point. 90 years of keeping this a secret. But in the
50s, myself, I'm a Bob Lazar skeptic. However, I know that you and I,
I'm going to convert you. I'm going to convert this. You. Yeah.
I'm looking forward to it. I did order the book. It's somewhere in my house. And you know much more about him and his stories than I do. But I'm currently on the straddling the fence when it comes to Bob Lazar. But maybe it's just out of ignorance. I don't know. But
no. But once you read the book, he makes sense. He's actually a good writer because to me it was like if it was just a nice flow, and he explains almost week by week to his best of his knowledge of what took place, and it makes sense when you read it. He doesn't explain himself well in person because mm-hmm. people ask him questions out of sequence. So you never know in what sequence things happen, but in a book, he lays it out for you, which is quite nice. The biggest takeaway that I got from that was the secrecy and then the threats that he received. You know, even like he would go to the gym, come out, his car doors were all open, his car was rummaged through, like just mm-hmm. like you mentioned, psychological games. They probably can't go after a civilian, but these mercenaries that they hire, whatever, can. And a lot of people have been threatened their life, like, shut up. Like, we know where your daughter works. We know where your wife works. Like, when you get a threat like that, when you're a family person, mm-hmm. like, that's scary. Like, don't come after my family. I'll shut up.
Yeah, I can't right? imagine. Yeah.
Yeah.
My own advice for what I would do in that situation is to try to call the bluff. But if not in the situation where somebody's threatening my family, because I don't want them to call that bluff. But intimidation tactics like rummaging through your car seem to me to indicate the level of authority at which they're working. Like, okay, we can get around somebody's car and fuck with it. That right. doesn't, to me, say the same level as like a person who can just vanish your bank account or make you disappear or something. It seems pure intimidation. And I know that there are a lot of organizations that work this way. I, for instance, was once targeted by the Church of Scientology.
Wow.
I worked for an organization that did sort of
anti-cult. It's not easy to do that.
It's not. But they'll do stuff like kill your animals and things and plant bugs in your office and things. But that also shows they really don't have any real authority. And I would imagine that most people who are doing intimidation stuff like that are kind of bullshit artists. But don't call their bluff when it comes to your family, I guess. But no, that's very troubling. So he comes out and he has all these things rummaging through his car and threatening his family. after working at S4 was the...
Yeah, so basically the gist of it is that his wife was having an affair with the flight instructor, and they know everything about it because obviously they had his phone tapped. They followed his wife. Like, it was a big deal that he worked there. They knew it was coming, that he eventually was going to find out what was going on. So they didn't want his personal life affecting the reverse engineering work. So, and to begin with, they were always calling him at different times during the day, like 2 o'clock in the morning, get ready, half an hour, your plane leaves, like just weird shit like that. He understood the level of secrecy that this was under. And, you know, once you start hearing, like, you know, the four Russian guys that were in the other department went missing, they're handing you a gun, like shit gets real pretty fast, especially for a young 24-year-old, like however old he was, right? So because of that, he started getting paranoid because, like, why aren't they calling me in? Like, why aren't they doing this? They were waiting for the storm to pass. But he screwed up. He thought his life was in danger. And then, of course, it was just a mess. It was a young 24-year-old, newly married, messy life, messy situation. And it didn't get any better from that. But he was the original whistleblower, as far as I'm concerned, that came out and said, we have 9 of these buggers. Now there's 12 or something, but 9 of these buggers, and we're trying to reverse engineer it. And everything he explained is coming to light now. Element 115, everybody laughed at him like, that doesn't even exist. It does now. It's on periodic table. Like, you know, he's being vindicated, even with David Grush coming forward and saying that there's reverse engineering program. Dude, in 1989, he said the exact same thing. You know what I mean? So it's just 30 years of his life being ruined. So he deserves, like I said, a lot more, I wouldn't say praise, but just admiration for standing up for what's right, right? Telling the general population, these guys are up to this. And this is real. Like, even we talked with Jim Goodall, and Jim's like, right before he took the job at S4, he did not believe in aliens. He's like, that stuff is phony baloney. Like, it's complete nonsense. Gets a job at S4 and he changes his mind really quick. Right. Sure. So, but the lengths of which they go through, the things that he's heard, even David Grush mentions, you know, this is kept under wraps, and, you know, with the threat of death, and the threat of death is always there, especially with a secret that big. Right. And that's what, and like, even we're talking to Married Rodwell in Australia, her life was ruined. She's divorced. Like, there's implications to this field. Sure. It's not easy, and we're fighting against the current big time. Right.
Well, the one thing that I would say, and thinking through those details that you just gave about Bob Lazar's life, is that it definitely pushes me to the point where I think either he's an extremely dedicated bullshit artist, or
like committed.
I mean, like, it's a lot of detail, like the sort of MC Escher of bullshit artists, or there's some substantial truth to it. But maybe more importantly, and practically important for anybody who is considering blowing the whistle, he did blow the whistle and he's still alive, which illustrates a general point, is that if you're considering blowing the whistle and you're afraid, the best thing you can do for your safety is to become a whistleblower.
Yeah.
Because if somebody steps up and says something and then they vanish, it's just really obvious what happened to them, right? And people start freaking out. Right? But it's in that moment before you blow the whistle that you're probably most vulnerable. So if you're listening to this and you're considering blowing the whistle on the government or your employer, do it immediately. That's my advice. As an ethicist, professional ethicist hat on right now, blow the whistle.
Yeah. And go hard, right? Like, don't go soft about it. Like, be everywhere. Make sure you get noticed. And it's important. We need these people to come forward. And even people within the military, they enlist to serve their country, but they have no idea that this stuff is going to happen. They're put on a base and all of a sudden things gets pretty wild. They're not expecting that. And when they come out of service, they're told, okay, you don't talk to it about it. Like, I just can't imagine going on your daily life, going to Walmart with the family, knowing everything that you know about reality and knowing that nobody else around you does. That's got to be isolating, you know?
I think so. And I think before, like, Vietnam, there was a totally different attitude that people had, especially in North America, towards their governments, where it was like, the government's doing the right thing, and I know these secrets, but I've got to keep it inside me for national security because the government's watching out for us. I think after Vietnam and the sort of ensuing, you know, Watergate and all these other things that sort of exposed the government as not really working in your best interest and not being totally honest all the time and not being the good guy all the time, that attitude has started to fade. And what that does is that incentivizes the government to try to enforce secrecy in other ways rather than just through like your own dedicated admiration and fidelity to the government. And all those other ways of incentivizing it are probably the dark, nefarious kinds of ways that make you afraid to tell the truth.
Right. Now, I often think that, disclosure, the way it's going right now, is going to be marketed. And you and I were talking about that on Friday, how it's going to start generating income for a lot of people. This is going to be a big topic. There's going to be superstars, and there's going to be the experts that are on TV, and exclusives are going to be signed, contracts are going to be signed, money will be handed down. The ethical aspect of this, though, it's like we're gonna start marketing disclosure. What are your thoughts on that?
To my immediate thought is, to the extent that somebody is getting paid to talk about this stuff directly, like being paid to come on to 60 Minutes or whatever it is,
Right.
those are the people you don't really need to listen to, right? But for a few reasons. One, journalism doesn't operate by paying sources of information. And there's a really good reason for that. If you start offering money for information, it incentivizes people to like gin up and sensationalize the information they can give you as much as possible to make it as valuable as they can. And that's really bad for the information economy. You want information that's just clean and precise and coming from sources who are just interested in getting the information out there and informing the public. So avoid those sources. And the people who have information should also really avoid any opportunities to be paid for it. I mean, I know it's enticing or whatever, but it's kind of a trade-off. It's like a deal with the devil. If you start getting paid $50,000 to come onto a, whatever, I don't know if Joe Rogan pays anybody for his podcast or
I
whatever
think he just
podcast
flies
makes
them
the
in or
most
something like
money.
that. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Well, good. That's a very good thing. Good job, Joe Rogan. But if you start getting offers to be paid for it, you've got to take the high road and turn that down, because all it's going to do is pollute the information economy, and it's going to take you out of the world of being able to like actually be involved with the information that you're working with. Because if you've got a calendar full of paid interviews, you're going to be too busy doing that to actually stay involved with the material that you're supposed to be working with, or that you have any hands on. So yeah, the idea that this is going to become a commodity, this information is going to be commodified, is just miserable to me. I mean, it happens anytime information is commodified, it just sucks for everybody.
Yeah, then you just think about, like, is there going to be like a circus that comes through town with a couple of dead bodies and you got to pay to see?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, just an absolute, what we normally do as a species, you know what I mean? Capitalize on it if we can. The one other topic before I let you go, we were talking about people making decisions on our behalf. When they
Sure. Yeah.
decide to blow the atomic bomb. They had no idea if it was going to light the atmosphere on fire, but they said, "Yeah, hit the switch. Let's see
Yeah.
how this plays out." And
Excellent hook into the Oppenheimer film, which is, I know, I think you haven't seen it yet, but it's an
no, I
incredible
haven't yet.
film. If anybody hasn't, it is totally worth it, and very faithful to the biography that it was made off of. But I get your point. You're saying making decisions for us, you gave the atomic bomb example, but what is the example when it comes to the UAP disclosure stuff? I think there was a hook in there.
Yeah.
What is
Well,
it?
the hook is basically people making decisions on their behalf of whether, not only the reverse technology, but if there is interactions with them, it's on their terms. You know what I mean? It's not a
Yeah.
global, we didn't agree to this. It's basically a selected group of people making decisions for everyone,
Yeah,
without oversight.
it's
Without
not
oversight.
democratized. Yeah,
No.
there's no democracy, there's no oversight. It's yeah, how else could it be though? Is you can't put these things to a vote because it puts out too much information for people who you might not want to have the information, but it's certainly too much responsibility for anybody to, bear on their own. So like, I guess, well, let's think of an example. We have a craft that's crashed, like easy sci-fi example. A craft has crashed, it's got some sort of anti-gravity tech on it, and we're trying to figure out how it works. We're going to reverse engineer it, or and see how we can weaponize it, for instance. I mean, anti-gravity tech could be weaponized really, really easily.
And scarily, yeah, scary,
I mean, that's something I wonder, especially about in these congressional hearings is why it hasn't come up that if we have these objects that can accelerate to like Mach 5 instantly, why we aren't worried about the weaponization of them? Because you wouldn't even have to attach a payload to it. You could just slam one of those things into a nuclear power plant and you'd get a really big catastrophe. And our weapons, like, you know, our missile interception systems wouldn't work at all against something that could maneuver that way. But I haven't heard that discussion at all, and that seems conspicuous to me. I think it's supposed to be something that's de-emphasized in these discussions, probably for good reason, to not freak out the public or whatever. But yeah, what do we say about people who are put in these positions of extreme decision-making power? What do you think you would do? I don't know what I would do. I mean, if it's kind of like if you were given the opportunity, wouldn't you reason, well, somebody else is going to have the same opportunity, Orion is going to have the same opportunity, and you know what they're going to do, so I guess we should do it? Is that kind of how you'd think? Or
you know, I think it should not be a group and organizations that decide these things. And if they do, it's because they must have their reasons. You know, every organization has their reasons, but a panel, and the panel votes on decisions being made when it comes down to this. The panel is elected by the people. The panel doesn't need to discuss necessarily what's going on behind the scenes, but they need to have oversight over everything. Mm-hmm. Right now, there's so many different compartments, and I don't know who's running the show. It's hard to find. Right. It's kind of like that cup trick, you know, with the ball, and you got to find where the ball is. And it's difficult. This is why ufology is difficult and frustrating, because, you know, there's people pulling the strings behind the scenes, but they're fighting against you. You're fighting amongst ourselves, you know, with who's an idiot, who knows more. And you're fighting the media. You're fighting people that are going to be making money now, the all-stars. It's going to be a tough gig. Disclosure. And the thing is, there's got to be a way where we can make a decision as a civilization on how we progress with this. That it should not be compartmentalized to such a small group that doesn't operate within radar, that's not accountable, that there's no oversight. That's a scary bit, because those people have the ultimate control. You know, it's not the government, it's not the president of the United States, it's those people. That's a scary bit.
Yeah, that's the Oppenheimers. That's our new concept that we need, the Oppenheimers, who are, you know, roped in and who find themselves in positions of extraordinary decision-making power, but who never asked for it and who aren't qualified for it, because nobody's qualified to make a decision for like all of humanity.
On this subject, I don't see how anybody's overqualified to handle this case.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, even the people we elect probably wouldn't be. I wouldn't know what to look for in a person to elect. I guess just general trustworthiness. But I think maybe a strategy that we should think more about is something analogous to the strategy of mutually assured destruction in nuclear weapons.
Right.
Once everything got out, once nuclear weapon making knowledge got out, the basic principles, and anybody who had good scientists could conceivably create one, we adopted that strategy by saying, well, look, everybody will just build as many weapons as they can, as they need, in order to make sure that they could kill everybody else. And that way, if we start a war, we know that we're all dead. So that'll kind of incentivize us not to start a war. Maybe that's the only way through this. And I don't like the mutually assured destruction path for nuclear weapons, because it involves me being destroyed if we ever start a nuclear war. But it might be the only way that we could ever get a sort of like democratized approach to what to do with this technology. If we knew that everybody had it and we were just totally transparent about who had what and what we had, and let other people look at that same information, then we could maybe progress without fear, because it's really just like fear of it falling into the wrong hands that makes us make bad decisions, and it turns us into the wrong hands, you know, as this kind of like pernicious effect of corrupting your own intentions. I don't know, but I also wonder, like, from a big grand scheme, is this like part of the test of humanity? Is it that at some point you encounter others who have like a vastly greater technological knowledge than you do, and if you find a way to make it through, that's like you haven't wiped yourself out and you get to progress as a civilization? Because I'm sure that if you ran this test a million times with different civilizations, an enormous portion of them would just wipe themselves out through bad decision making or accidentally or something. I don't know. I mean, it'll be interesting to see how it works out, and it'll depend a lot on the specifics of what it actually is in the hands of the government. I mean, we know there's something there. They are saying there's something there. We have tons of CIA documents from like the 70s saying there's something there. So we need to know the specifics, I guess. Are you worried? You're a parent. Is this like end of the world worry for you?
No, I mean, I talk with my wife and my kids about it openly. I've always been open with my kids since they were little. I always told them Santa Claus isn't real. He's a character of Christmas. And if Tooth Fairy isn't real, it's mom, right? I've always been bluntly honest with my kids. Even teach them chess because it teaches them critical thinking. And it teaches them not to necessarily believe something just because it's being said. And I talked to them about the UAP subject. And I mean, not everything, obviously. They're little still and their attention doesn't last very long, but yes, I talk to them about it, and it's not end of world things. I teach them about human corruption and lies and deceit and the hurt that causes, because you don't necessarily need to kill somebody, but just through lies and omissions and you can definitely destroy somebody's life until they take their own, right? It's horrible, but like I said, there's crimes that are still being committed when it comes down to this. And like David Grush came out and he's afraid, like the threats were made on his life, on his family's life. Those are serious accusations, because it means that the people that employed him to do his job are now telling them you shut up or there'll be consequences. So my hat's off to him being able to come out. And like I said, we'll hear a lot more as this comes forward. Not only through other people that have been threatened, but people that they know that went missing or something happened to them. Like, it's not good, whatever this is. And if they're evil, we need to know. If they're good, we need to know. If they're sort of neutral, we need to know. It's a basic right, I think, as an entity living on this realm to know what we're dealing with, right? As an adult, I don't know how old you are, Michael, but I'm 42. And I think I've lived this long. I'm raising kids. I paid my taxes. I should know what reality is. Yeah. And this is the point of this podcast, is just to say this might be a big part of reality that we're overlooking, and we need to look into it. We need to start really focusing on it. It's going to be complex, difficult roadblocks. Tim Burchett mentioned the amount of roadblocks that he had trying to get. This is a congressman, for crying out loud. So yeah, the game is definitely there. And like I said, they're still playing, Mike. They haven't gone away, you know.
There's no doubt. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's one thing I wanted to throw by you. I don't want to like take the reins of your podcast.
Please.
I've been thinking through an argument lately that if it's right, might just like throw an enormous wrench into the entire UAP discussion that we're having right now. I want to run it by you. I'm gonna write this out and publish it somewhere, but maybe you can be like my test. You and your object audience can be my test subject. So I've been, just as a side project, reading a lot about military history, military deception history, right? And thinking about like in strategy, how when you have an adversary who's not necessarily your enemy, but you have different aims, how it's often best to just have them left in the dark or believing something totally wrong, right? That puts you in the best position. If you know what's going on and they're deceived, you can kind of control what they're thinking and doing all the time. And so I've been thinking that if there's a non-human intelligence out there that's acting and doing things rationally, and they have some technology and their technology allows them to go really fast and even cloak. I think that's one of like the five observables that Louis Elizondo keeps talking about is cloaking. Seems to be some form of technology that's present there. Isn't it like necessary that we draw the conclusion that they are to some degree confusing or intentionally displaying themselves differently than they really are, right? So for instance, you could imagine a UFO looking like a normal passenger plane just to avert interest or something. But you could also do lots of other things. You make it look like a cloud or whatever, or might just make it look invisible. So I think the first step of the argument is that we have to assume that there's an incentive that whoever's running these technologies, they have an incentive to mislead us and to sort of control our perception of them and to confuse us or to make us not see them or see something that isn't there, right? And so the question is then, how far should we assume that they're going and doing that? How much of what we see is constructed purely for our own advantage or their advantage, and how much of it is real? The assumption that seems to prevail throughout all of these discussions is that whenever we see something, it's really what's there, right? Somebody right. says, I see a gigantic football field-sized red cube in Texas. That means there was a gigantic football-sized, you know, football field-sized red cube in Texas. I don't know if I think that that's the right conclusion to draw, given that we know that there's some sort of like deception ability and a deception incentive there. What's more likely, that we accidentally caught them with all of this like really advanced technology that we have, that they have, that we accidentally caught them with their pants down or their cloaking shield off, or that they strategically chose to allow us to see this? It seems that if they're as smart as they seem to be and as technologically advanced as they seem to be, seems extremely unlikely to me that we ever catch them with their pants off. It seems much more likely that the times when we think that we've just caught something and seen it against their intentions, that they probably intended us to see it. Even if it means something like retrieving a crashed piece of technology or something, it seems to me at least as likely that they just dropped something there that was made specifically for us to find and tinker with than it is that they accidentally crashed a ship, because I assume that their, like, you know,
yeah,
crash avoidance systems are just as good as their cloaking or acceleration systems are. So the conclusion of this bizarre argument is that probably any observation we've made, whether it's a, you know, just a visual observation or radar or catching a flying saucer crashing into a field, it's probably constructed for our deception or to make us think something rather than just the bald truth that we think it is. Does that strike you as totally nuts?
It is, but you know what, too? And I understand your point of view, because it's just weird how these experiences happen. They let you see them and then they take off. Or they're captured on radar, or like, and I know for a fact that they've upgraded their radars on ships, and, you know, especially now they have nuclear ships and stuff like that. The radars capture activity around them all the time. I'm just going to address the crash situation. How often do we hear about an airplane crash?
Very rare.
They're one of the safest ways of travel, but they do happen, right? But at any given day, you have hundreds of thousands of planes in the sky, you know, traveling the world, and we hear about it every once in a while. I think it's the same thing with these guys. They're so active that it's impossible. At some point, one of them is going to crash. It's just inevitable, but it does happen. Their activity here is a lot more prevalent than we give them credit for. It's not like they come from somewhere else, enter our atmosphere, and then take off. They're here. They stay here. They stay here for a long time, right? Mm-hmm. They hover above the oceans for 24 hours and they don't move. That stuff is scary. And they're small crafts. That's just the small stuff. Those mm-hmm. are just the cruisers. Imagine what else they got, right? That's a scary bit. Is this the stuff that we see here? That's just to facilitate their job. But to tell the truth, Mike, I think that they know our limits. They know the boundaries of which we can experience this objective reality. And that's through our five senses. They know exactly what spectrum of light we can see. So then they operate outside those boundaries. Same with audible tones and stuff like that. There could be noises out there that we can't hear because it's outside of our hearing spectrum.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Right. So I think if you're a species that is above, like, it's the same with like, saying, okay, well, chimps can't, let's say, see color. I don't know if that's true. Don't quote me on that. I have
they
to Google
can,
it.
That's okay. Yeah.
Let's say they can't see color. Well, you know, you would operate on the terms that they can't see red, they can't see green. You know what I mean? Like, you have information on them and you use it against them. It's the same thing with these entities. What scares me more is the ability to manipulate thoughts, not only on one individual, but multiple individuals, because it doesn't matter how many jets you would throw at it and how armed that jet is. If they tell the pilot to shut off, the pilot shuts off. That's it. The mission is done. And that's the thing about this phenomenon, which is really weird, is that when we do and when we can get close to them, it's almost like they play cat and mouse with us. Like, it's just they zoom out or they start flying circles around us. Just make us aware of their superiority that, you know, like, this is cute. The kids are coming out to play, right? That's part of the phenomenon that is aggravating, because as an adult, you want to be taken seriously. If you're $1 million trained pilot, you know, flying jets, like, you want to be taken seriously. That's your job. And this thing makes us feel stupid. It very much does, right? Like toddlers with scissors. That's exactly what it is. So when you're saying that, you know, the differences between that, and I think that's exactly it. Sometimes they're like, okay, it's okay, you can see it. And then sometimes, no, we need to operate in secret. So it's weird. It really is. And people say, oh, it could be the government. Why would the government act like that? What rationale is there, or logic is it, to acting like that? There isn't. It's an alien way of behaving. And you were mentioning about the crafts, and sometimes they do seem like other crafts. They'll imitate a plane. One gentleman was, we were talking to Chris O'Brien, and he was mentioning about a helicopter in a field. And everybody could see it. Those lights, it never made a sound. Big helicopter, like, what helicopter do you know doesn't make a sound, right? Like, it cuts air. You're going to be some sound waves. Nothing. Yeah. So it's fascinating. Like, the tricks and the minds, like, even abductees, they'll see things that aren't there. They can't make out what's real, what's not. Keeping us confused, right? It's nasty, but the more I delve into it, the more intrigued I am. I'm like, why? What's the reasoning behind it? Right?
Yeah, the same. And I just think that there has to be some percentage, at least some percentage, of the observations we've made that were constructed for our, either to be misled or for our benefit or for their benefit. And they're totally not what we see on the radar or see in our video screens or something. And then the question is just, what percentage of those are true or veracious? That what percentage of them have veracity and truthiness to them? And now I've become like, just, I've thought through this argument so many times that I've become kind of skeptical that there's any of it. Anytime I hear any report now, I think, okay, was that really what was there? Did we really just catch them unaware, or do they intend for us to see this? And if they intended for us to see this, why? It's not just because that's what's there. It's because there was some strategic decision being made there, and they have to be good strategic decision makers if you got great technology. I mean, you don't get, you know, cloaking or anti-gravity tech by being a dummy.
No. But even the way these things fly, like the interactions with jets, like, it's cute, right?
Yeah.
Well, as far as we know, there might be some nasty interactions, but the way that they sort of just play around and, like, you know, oh, you were going to go here? I'll go there first.
Yeah, I'll be there first. Yeah.
It's, man, this is the part that blows my mind. And I know that we always talk about the technology that's involved. For me, it's the entities, man. Like, the technology will come once you know more about the entities. And that's the part that fascinates me. Like I said, that's why the phenomenon of abduction fascinates me the most, Mike, is that you want to know why they're here. Just look at the abductees. See what they say to the abductees, what they do to the abductees, right? If we study that, I think we'd be further ahead. And I know Congress has put together Arrow and all that, but I think where they're failing is that they're not getting the experts they should have. I would put on a panel philosophers, scientists, people that work in the field, like MUFON, and apply them, people that have volumes of work that investigate, like Jacques Vallée's an advisor, like, put people that know what they're doing and have investigated this for years or can actually contribute something. Like, for you, your philosophy, dude, a book. You know, write a book, the government procedures, what happens if this takes place? Like, I'm sure they have people like that already in place.
I actually don't think public. They do. I think that's one of those cases where we think, like, oh, certainly the government would do blank. But, man, it is hard to get the government to take anybody seriously who is not talking to them about money. And that is just
good
not
point.
What
good point.
We do. You know,
it's not. Yeah, they're about the cash, right?
Yeah. Yeah. They want to see the Benjamins. They want to see a sort of like computational benefit that they're going to get out of this. And a lot of times the most important questions are not computable in that sort of way.
Yeah. But again, I think it's linear. Like, we just focus on one thing at a time on this subject when we should be looking at the whole. There's a whole phenomenon. It's not just that these things are in our air or water or rivers, but that they're everywhere, right? The most important part of the videos that they released back in 17 was when he said there's a whole fleet of them. Look on the NSA or ASA or whatever, a whole fleet of them. That is the best part of the whole videos, is to admittance like from a pilot that he's captured more than just one.
Yep.
Right? Like that is cool. Scary, but cool at the same time, right?
I think the more that we look at the phenomenon holistically, the more the boundaries of it are going to start to kind of erode, and it's going to become clear that there's not a clear delineation between UAP phenomenon and what we've considered religious phenomena sometimes. Right. Or between psychological or psychical phenomena, or even like my quiet prediction is 50 years from now, occult phenomena are going to be starting to be taken seriously in the same way that like maybe UAP phenomena like this are. And I'm not an occultist or a Wiccan or anything,
right.
But I think there's just so much overlap in the same way that there's overlap with like religious traditions and what we think of as UAP if we're not particularly in a religious mode of thought. Those overlaps are so strong that it becomes impossible to ignore the more you start thinking along the boundaries of it.
Yeah, and you're right. I think that we're kind of seeing that now, not to the same extent, but within ufology, there's like key people that are like, nope, I'm the guy that's going to follow me. I have all the answers. Sure. It's very dangerous. It's very dangerous because, like I said, it leads people to dangerous conclusions and the messiah complex, and that's the biggest fear, is to this is not the field to do this in. This requires
teamwork.
Need to have
as many voices as possible, as many
absolutely
diverse voices as possible.
Absolutely, hands down. Mike, what are you working on? Like, what could we look forward to coming up? I know we were talking on Friday about maybe you writing an article soon, so explain
to
us what you're doing.
I've got an article I'm working on with Scientific Coalition of UAP Studies. We're going to try to publish something maybe in Scientific American or some other sort of popular publication, just about how science is best done right now, especially when it comes to like the UAP phenomena. There's a lot of very like high profile science headlines that are like super catchy, but that don't really push any sort of scientific dialogue forward in a substantial way. And so we kind of want to like put a voice out there that says, let's lean a little more towards the normal process of science of collecting information, data, and submitting it publicly and to other experts and having a rich conversation like that, rather than immediately pushing your conclusions or your hopes for what the phenomenon might be into the headlines of, you know, Vox or New York Times or something, and getting a bunch of clicks and then it just kind of falling off. So we're hoping that we can encourage more substantial scientific discussion among scientists and the public who's interested in science. That's one thing. Another thing is I'm outlining this article on my argument for why maybe we shouldn't really put any faith into the content of our UAP observations. Maybe they're all strategic tricks or something. I don't know if I actually believe that argument, but I think it's an argument that's worth making, which is kind of a
worth
thing
debating.
It's worth the debate. You know, that's kind of how philosophers think. We say, let's lay the argument out and then see if it's any good. I think this argument could be made, and then you say, well, maybe I like it, maybe I don't know, but at least need to see it in its fullness before we make a decision. So those are two things I'm writing now, and I don't have a specific place that I have decided to publish them yet, but they'll be somewhere visible once they come out, and I'll definitely let you know.
Yeah, man, we'll definitely share it on everywhere on Twitter and all that. Like,
and people
have really responded to like the last episode we had you on. Like, they really enjoyed that, because this, like I said, philosophies and that I don't hear it enough in ufology, and I think it's very important. Is there a discipline you think that needs to be applied here that hasn't really shown any interest yet?
It's going to sound bizarre. Science fiction writers.
Oh, really?
I see so little overlap between serious science fiction writers and discussions about the phenomena. But genuinely, some of the best theoretical serious thought that's being done about the phenomena is in science fiction. Some of them are dead, but authors like Stanislaw Lem, Adrian Tchaikovsky, Peter Watts, these people are all... Mary Doria Russell, just lots of sci-fi writers are doing very, very serious thought. They're just doing it within the framework of a narrative rather than an article that you publish in Nature or whatever. But the ideas are just as good and serious. And they tend to stick in that fiction world rather than talking about how their ideas might apply to reality. And honestly, they apply straightforwardly. So
yeah,
if you have any opportunity to rope a good sci-fi writer into the podcast, I say do it.
Yeah, I'm a big sci-fi fan myself. Like I've read my fair share, and I often believe that even Ringworld, I mean, as far as fetch as that was a crazy good book, I still enjoyed it. But it makes it, it's great because the authors can actually think outside the boundaries, outside the box. And sometimes there's a lot of wise things that they come up with. Like these people sit there all day long sitting and thinking about this. So you're right. Like we need more people thinkers on this as much as possible. And I often say, you know, when like a company's having a problem, they throw it out to the public and the public comes up with a solution. This is what we need to do with the general population.
Ooh, crowdsourcing. I love it.
Crowdsourcing. Yeah. You know, like, guys, I'm having an issue. Does anybody have any ideas? And man, the geniuses that are out there is insane. Like, why are we not tapping into that potential? Yeah, so, Mike, what we're going to do, we talked about this before, but we're going to have you back on. And as a host, as a co-host, we're going to have you on every once in a while. Come and talk with somebody that you recommend, of course, great minds, any great discussions. As for the listeners, if you can like and subscribe, if you haven't done that yet, that'd be appreciated. And we are in full swing again with the podcast recording. I don't know if I'll be putting out an episode every single week, but I will try to do at least two to three times a month, at least put out some content, which is good. And I appreciate everybody for following the podcast. Please follow Michael. Michael, where can people follow you?
You can follow me on Twitter at Michael Glosson, or you can find me in my Linktree, which is just Linktree, / Michael Glosson. So if you know my name, Google it and you'll find me. And dude, I can't wait to come on and help host with you. And we'll rub some people into really good discussions here.
Absolutely. And for any other podcast hosts out there, Michael's a great guest. I highly recommend his intellect on your podcast. It comes in handy talking with smart people. Like by the time I'm off, I feel good. You know, I feel like I've learned something. So that's very good. Man.
Absolutely mutual, dude. I love our discussions. So I look forward to being back.
Awesome. Thanks, Mike. Appreciate it, man. Yeah.